Yeah, this is Ben Gillette, a little bit disoriented because we were saying too much funny stuff off the air. Now it's time to get serious and be on the air. Yesterday, as you recall, when the show ended, I was screaming, Lewis Black, Lewis Black, Lewis Black, and that's because today our guest is Lewis Black, and he's brought along with him John Bowman.
Yes.
Who is your opening act? Where are you playing this weekend?
We're playing at the beautiful MGM Hollywood Theater.
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. That's where David Copperfield plays?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm in Tom Jones and Lewis Black. I finally homogenized myself into, you know, I'm basically... I've always described success as you become what it is that you hate.
So you hate Tom Jones? Is what you're saying here?
No, I don't.
Is there some sort of big show business riff?
Tom Jones. Yeah, really. I don't have panties thrown at me.
You don't.
Do you?
No. You know, I had this great conversation with Iggy Pop once. You know, and Iggy Pop said to me, we were in New York, and Iggy Pop said to me, "Oh man, you gotta play like Scandinavia because you do these shows and all the." Girls get like their boyfriend's shoulders, and they're like these blonde, tall, busty girls, and they like rip their tops off, and you'll be there on stage, and you're looking out there, it's just a field of breasts and these beautiful Scandinavians. And I went, Iggy, that's for an Iggy Pop show. That wouldn't happen at the Penn & Teller show. And he goes, oh, yeah, you're right. So that's what we played the MGM, too. We were completely pantyless.
Yeah.
Not one thrown at us.
Well, it's that whole concept of that somehow, you know, the comedy is equal to being, is equal to rock and roll, and that's a myth. Yeah. That is, you know, because you're funny, but you're never that funny.
and it's generally, it's not the ones that you'd picture, the ones, oh, her panties are the ones I want thrown at me. They're mostly off-center, kooky people who are attracted to his bitter, screaming, yelling message. You know, so you got to figure that some of them are right on the edge of being dangerous anyway.
Right. So they might be throwing like weird pre-picked chastity belts.
Right.
Just throw them on this twisted metal that looks like it had a blowtorch taken to it. Let's throw this at Lewis Black. See what he does. He's probably into that.
Yeah. He is lying. Where were we in Atlanta? He had panties thrown at him one night.
Once. Yeah. No, we were in. It was Houston, because I'll never forget it. And it wasn't really thrown. Kind of taut. It was fired at me. You know, like a rubber band, and it went bam, and it ended up literally on my glasses. And so
it hung there,
and I just, it may have been the happiest moment of my life. That's how sad it is.
Now, when you say, well, how was it propelled? By the band? By the stretchy band?
By the band.
So it was kind of a self-contained slingshot.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Just, it was like she had a catapult built in the audience.
That's how large they were.
Well, were they attractive panties?
They were.
Yeah.
Like a thong?
Like a thong.
Yeah, are we sure this is sexual in nature and not a threat? They might have been just shooting at your head to shut you up.
She probably had a rock in it. The rock fell out and the panty just went.
What do you got for ammunition? Could I throw up? What would hurt him? Let's throw this thong at him. They probably had a cigarette wrapped in it. It was probably an incendiary device. They were something called a Budapest cocktail or something. And you just let it sit on your glasses for a while.
For a good minute.
Yeah, it was funny.
That's the people who get panties sort of them regularly aren't wearing glasses. Another thing.
Yeah. There's not a natural built-in hanging area.
You don't think of, oh, Tom Jones was wearing those really sexy horn rims that night. Those are very attractive glasses that Tom had. And did you later track her down?
Yeah, she
by
came,
scent?
She came scent. Oh, man. I knew. I wondered which of us was going to hit that button. Yeah. And I'm glad you took it.
I had no doubt which one of us was going to hit that button. But she came back
with her friends. They come to. They actually have been. When I go to Houston, they show up at the shows.
Were they thrown ironically, or were they thrown with pure sexual intent?
They were thrown by accident.
I think as a gesture, because they are real fans. But isn't she married or something?
Probably.
Yeah, it was a gesture of how much we love you. But the funny thing is, and when things go wrong on stage, and or when somebody does something, stands up in the audience and throws up on a table, and then everybody later goes, "Does that guy do that every night?" Doesn't that kill you? You're like, "Oh yeah, we've got a guy that throws up on the table every night." That's all we care about our show. But everybody was saying, how do you get that to work where it hangs on your glasses like that? Every night after night do you do it?
Yeah, the closest thing I came to that was there was a plague of locusts in Vegas. Maybe you read about it. It was in the Bible. And there was a plague. There were a lot of grasshoppers. They come by all the time. And the grasshoppers got into the ventilation system of the MGM. Wow. So while I was out doing monologues, sometimes grasshoppers would drop on me. And I discovered the greatest thing in the world. Because these grasshoppers are phototropic, and so they would want to go to the brightest place. And I was wearing a shirt that was very bright, of course, in the spotlight, and the rest of the theater is dark. So a grasshopper would come down during my monologue, land on my shirt, and I would say, this is my trained grasshopper, right? And I would take the grasshopper, and I would throw it in the air, and it would spin into the spotlight, get confused, and come back and land on my shirt. And it was completely and utterly repeatable. I had a trained grasshopper. And Teller, during this monologue, would be backstage, and he'd have his time. You know, we got 8 minutes now. That's when I'm backstage. I can do this stuff. And the crew guys would go back and go, Penn's got a grasshopper. And Teller would just put his feet up, open the book, and know that he had another 8 minutes. Because by the end of that plague, I had a good solid 8 minutes of grasshopper material. You know, I would talk about how grasshoppers love juggling because they have a compound eye. Right. So it looks like I'm doing 12.
You know, John actually...
he has grasshopper material?
No, but better. He's got some Shelties. And for a time there, in his act, when he was on the road, he would have the dog worked with him.
The dog until I hired him.
The dog was paying him more.
The first thing was by mistake. I realized that I just brought him up on stage, and I try to just to let things, you know, come into my head sometimes, and so. He 30 seconds into when he, because he runs up and he jumps on a stool and everybody thinks, wow, because he looks like a little lassie. Here he goes. And, well, 30 seconds after, you could time him. He would yawn, a big dog yawn, and his tongue would come out and stretch out. So I wouldn't look at him. And what I would do in that 30 seconds was tell the audience how excited he is to be with me and about the anticipation every day, and that I have to tell him throughout the day, 4 more hours to the show, because my presence to him, truly, and I work up a tear in my eye, and then he goes, and the audience would just scream laughter. But the other thing he does is I can't wear a hat, or he rips it off my head. I taught him to do that when I came in to take my hat off. It's just a funny thing. He doesn't. But what I did is I got a hat.
You know, that kind of act cannot be taught with kindness.
Yeah. Oh, well, yes, it can.
You can't train with kindness.
I got a hat, and this is bad. I guess I'm going to tell it. I tie it so you can't pull it off, and he's he wants it off. So what I did is I told the audience that Ike and I reenacted the tragic mauling of Roy at the so I get down on the floor, and he just... and he tried, and I just keep screaming, Siegfried, use your magic! Oh, God, that takes this dark tiger! Use your magic! Actually, I put that in the bio. We did Carnegie Hall, and they asked me for a bio, and so that's what I wrote, that I traveled the country with Shelties reenacting the tragic moment.
You know, it's pretty interesting that trying to find the one kind of act on stage that's less likely to have panties thrown at them than a comic, it's a dog act. I would think a dog act, because the humiliation of throwing your panties at a performer, having a dog grab them and run off stage with them, is so great, even worse than landing on Lewis's glasses.
Have you ever, we were at theater recently, and the grasshopper thing reminded me of, you know, where you're on stage and you're in a big theater, and there's a silence. You know, you achieve that, you got the audience, and there's a cricket in the theater.
they're still at the MGM.
Yeah, you're there, and you just all of a sudden you just hear it's cricket, like the nightmare of just you're listening to crickets.
And have you ever tried commenting on it? Because no one else ever hears it.
No, exactly.
If you comment on it, you are then showing that you are the most psychotic entertainer they've ever seen. We're enjoying the show. He's really talented. He's really good. He loses his train of thought for a second, and then says, "You hear that goddamn cricket? You hear that cricket?" It's like silence. It's like, yeah, I tried commenting on a cricket once, and the audience just goes, yeah. Man, he's crazier than we thought. Maybe he does beat Teller. It's just, we're a little frightened of him now.
Yeah.
Have you ever met Tom Jones?
No.
Because you would throw your panties at him. Have you seen his show?
I actually have seen him do two or three.
wait for the pause. For
No, I've stood in the back and watched him sing a couple of songs. It is kind of unbelievable.
He's unbelievable good he is. He's just unbelievable.
And the band. I mean, it's one of those shits that it's that legendary, you know, there's just a few guys even pull that stuff off.
And everybody else that's been around that long doesn't really sing the notes anymore. Yeah. They, like, cheat and do all this. I'm here and that's enough. You know, that's the that's the attitude. He hits all the notes. He, like, just, and he's just so true to himself. He wears whatever clothes he thinks look good. Yeah. You know, there's no sense of fashion. He covers whatever song he wants, and you just go, oh, that's what a man is supposed to be. Yeah. That's what my parents were trying to raise me to be, was Tom Jones. They failed. And the distance between me and Tom Jones is the distance that my parents were failures. You know,
measurable.
It's, you know, Jonathan Ross is the... is like the David Letterman of England. Got all these shows here. Yeah. And he told me this fabulous story before Kiss came out, before Tom Jones' version of Kiss, before he was cool again. He said he was doing this show, Jonathan Ross, where he'd be really mean to people, you know. And they invited Tom Jones on, and he was going to sing a song, and then he was going to come out. And he said his writers had put together a huge number of jokes trashing Tom Jones. How's it feel to be a fossil in Las Vegas and da 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 da, and all this really mean stuff, because that's what he did. And he said, and this is Jonathan speaking, he said, and because I'm a coward and not a real man, before I would tear someone apart on the air, I would try to meet them backstage and get them to say it was okay. So he said, I'd walk in and say, you know, we have a little fun on the show. We get a few jokes that are going to poke fun at you in Vegas. Is that okay? And he said, you'd say that to somebody, and they would just fall apart. You know, they just go, what are you going to say? What do you mean? And he said, then you'd kind of reassure them and it'd be kind of okay. Then you'd go out and humiliate them and the show would be over and you'd be doing fine. He said, so I go back to do this to Tom Jones. I never met him. Knock on his dressing room door. He's there with a few of his friends. He said, I walk in and I go, you know, we like to have a little fun on the show. I'll probably make some jokes at your expense. And Tom goes, fine. And goes back to talking. And he goes, I've never felt that kind of terror in my life. I just told him, I'm going to trash you on television here. And he just said, well, I'm a little busy right now, but thanks. And he says, well, I tried to make it worse. We've got some pretty mean jokes about you in Vegas. And Tom, he says, turns and goes, yes, we did a sound check. The band's going to sound fine. Very nice to meet you. I enjoy your show. And goes back to talking to his wife and his friend. He said, so I'm already trembling. He said, because it just isn't the way it's supposed to be. He said, I go out on stage and we introduce Tom Jones. And he said, this is in the late 80s. We have all the hippest bands on. We have, like, the youngest demographic. The crowd is really hip. I introduce Tom Jones. He comes out and he says, no one has ever killed in front of this audience like him. I mean, destroyed. Everybody's standing up, screaming, cheering. He said, he walks over to me, and I realize if I make one joke that's negative about him, he will... the audience will kill me.
Yes.
He said, so I just spent the entire 6 minutes interview going, you're the greatest entertainer that ever lived. You're just fabulous. And he said, the interview's over. And he said, I expect Tom Jones to say, hey, I thought you were going to make fun of me or something. He said, he stood up, looked me in the eye, and said, thank you very much, Jonathan, and went off with his friends. And he said, that's when I knew I had met a real man. And that's what Tom Jones comes across.
Yeah.
And that's why you throw your panties. I mean, one would throw their panties at him. Not that I did.
Yeah.
So hard to get boxers off on your feet. But it's just amazing. The MGM's a great, great room.
It is a great room.
How often do you do there a year?
No, it's 3 weeks a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to learn how to live here.
Yeah.
I'm not doing well. I'm not. You know, I mean, I've done it before. I used to come in and play like the Trop, and there was,
yeah.
And we'd do two shows a night, and it was three comics, and the, you know, your basic club comedy,
sure,
thing. And I got used to that. You know, it was 4 weeks here, and I got used to it. I figured out, you know, things that would distract me from, you know, drinking and gambling.
Uh-huh.
And but this, I'm still finding that adjustment. I mean, you live here, but it's a big, huge difference to come out to the out here to the Jones compound, and, which is great. I mean, it's great out here. I mean,
well, yeah.
You leave.
You leave, and I have parking. I mean, that's as you get older in show business, all that matters is parking. And I have parking that goes like, you know, it's like 10 yards to my dressing room.
Yeah.
No casino, no nothing, and I just do the show. And I never, you know, never see the casino and never see the strip. You know, you can sneak up. You have this, all the,
yeah,
the back. And someone was negotiating with us about, you know, you guys been at the Rio, how about coming to our place? And there's this big meeting with all these guys. We go, where's parking?
Yeah.
I mean, can we get there without going to the strip? You know, that shows that you're getting old is when you,
yeah.
Or I think, not you're getting old, you've plumb arrived at old. When the first question of the contract is not money or women, it's where would the parking be?
Yeah, well, the parking, when I was, I had a pilot we did, like, I did a pilot 3 years ago for whoever the hell it was then, and whatever group of initials, but the thing was, is, you know, the thing that was, you came on it a lot, and there was your name.
Yeah.
Right there, and you just drove into your space, and we finished taping the show. It's like, it's 11 o'clock at night, and I come out to my car, and I pull back, and my name is gone.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. That's it. They give it to you up, and that's it. You're out. Some other schmuck's name will be up there. That's it. You're toast.
It's that must be someone's full-time job, then.
Yeah.
To paint those on.
Oh, exactly.
To take them off.
Yeah.
And it's, he must just walk around with his stencils going, I build dreams, and I take them away. Spray paint in one hand, stencil in the other.
It's a union job.
Yeah. And so Vegas is not, you're not, see, I lived in the casino when we played here a lot. I would live here for, you know, 2-3 months.
Well,
and I didn't have a house here. But of course, I don't drink and I don't gamble.
Yeah.
So it was just, I did nothing.
What did you do? Would you just read?
I'd sit in my room and read.
Yeah.
Or work through the Dewey Decimal System?
Yeah, exactly. Try to memorize the Dewey Decimal System.
802.3.
I wonder if I can memorize this whole page of TV Guide. Wow. But I have a few rules. When I'm on the road, I won't watch any TV ever. You know,
wow.
Because I just think it's a time waster. So my choices are just read or sleep. You know, unless I don't have friends around. And for a while, I was going out with, like, you guys lived here.
Yeah.
But you've lived here the longest.
I have.
Was there a time when you lived like Vegas, when you, like, were going out every night? And
well, yeah, I guess actually the first year.
Yeah.
First year, we'd go out with the dancers every night after the show. You know,
Well, that's really when you have a show with dancers. You know, we were working at Jubilee, and we had.
I got John.
The whole yeah. And his dog.
No, we don't even have the dog.
The dog's not with you anymore.
No, can't. Lou doesn't allow the dog to travel in the show.
Is that true?
Well, because I would allow him, but I think he would steal our thunder.
Yeah.
We're just holding on to our position in show business, like, you know, by the nails. So.
He seriously, I did a play. I'm also an actor. I did a play at the Westport Country Playhouse at Joanne Woodward is the artistic director, and my dog Ike was in the play. And Paul Newman came, and I have a picture of Paul Newman with the dog, but I didn't get one of me. But Paul Newman, he came in, he went, where's that dog? That dog is brilliant. And I said, he's right here, he's my dog. He went, give me that dog. He had it up in his arm, and I went, let me get my camera, and I took a picture of it, but I didn't think about it. Same. You mind if I...
Yeah, put a
take a picture with a legend that I admire and
put a label on the dog's ass and sell it for charity. That's what Paul Newman
said.
He'd
probably have 15 patties every night, that dog.
We got Louis Black and John Bowman, and of course Michael Goudeau. My name is Penn Jillette. We'll be back after this on CBS, the free FM.
Come on. And let's hit the fake studio.
This is we're back with Louis Black and John Bowman questioning whether there even is a show going on, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think I'm just inviting out to my house because it really is boring.
Yeah, we're going to nowhere.
Yeah,
and it's fine by me. I think, you know, reality.
It's pirate radio. It's pirate
perfect.
Radio.
Yeah, we're just going out on the web.
the guy who drove us here is the only person listening to it.
Parking lot. He's sitting there just listening. It only broadcasts on my property. There's an FCC rule.
It only goes as far as the fence.
You were asking me about that article.
Yeah, I wanted to. Yeah, I was. You're the first one I thought of because you're the only one I know who really who does delve in the world of magic. Because I know some guys who do voodoo, but I was wondering there's this big thing going on in New York. This
huge, huge thing,
huge, massive for the community. You know, we've got you know, an unemployment problem, but this is really the thing. Is it, the,
it was that 9/11 thing, but this is, this is the thing.
But the, but there was a, there's a new, you know, magician kid.
Yeah, whose name I forgot.
And I forgot.
Which is, I think, really important part of the story.
Exactly.
That we don't know the name. That's how big a story it
is. I know that his haircut is kind of like Dane Cook's. That
yeah.
I know. And then, you know, and he's the new, you know, the new kid doing
sure.
his stuff. And so he's doing it. And Ricky Jay, who is, you know, one of yeah. the guys, the legends, comes in to see the show and gets, you know, livid because this guy is a, you know, Ricky Jay uses, you know, 4 or 5 syllable words.
This that was an odd part in the article, wasn't it?
He,
they had the two words
yeah,
that they used.
I got it. I got it.
Oh,
what are two words?
I am on it.
I knew there was a reason you were here.
Broad Degandigan and pachydermatous
yeah.
are the two words.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
they're, those two words, fighting over 4 syllables.
They didn't use, he didn't use the same word.
No, no.
It's just the number of syllables.
The number of syllables. And the whole idea of that, you know, Ricky Jay, you know, uses this kind of esoteric language.
Yeah.
And that this kid uses the esoteric language.
Well, and the other kid's show is called Esoterica.
Now, what's his name? Let's just give his name.
Eric Walton.
Eric Walton.
And Eric and Ricky gets upset because not only is he, you know, kind of using his style, he mm-hmm. thinks, I guess. I mean, I don't know.
They don't look similar.
They don't at all.
No.
Ooh,
Ricky
know.
Jay has hair.
And Ricky Jay got to do Deadwood.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how good is that? He was the guy, one of the little pigs in the saloon, in the other saloon, in the one with Powers Booth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, yeah, that was, you know, that's sad when you get excited about things. Oh, look, it's Ricky Jay. That'll give you an idea of my life.
But also what they're arguing about is, and you know, and this is the same thing in comedy. I mean, who did you steal that Chicken McNuggets bit from?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Everybody's all. Always talking in comedy. It's no different in magic, except the tricks that that Eric is doing are tricks that Ricky Jay did, but they aren't original with Ricky Jay.
Right.
They're tricks from like 100 years old. So he would go and find this esoteric axe and revive them. And the argument is really, did Eric get the idea of going back to old material from Ricky, or did he get the idea of going back to old material from the old material?
Right. Yeah.
And it's very strange because everybody in magic knows this history stuff, or many people do, and it's just all of a sudden someone will do one of those things and they'll go, oh, that would work? Yeah, I didn't know that would work. That's a whole new idea. I thought we were just reading about it. We had a promise and we weren't going to ever try that stuff. We just read about how great it was then. So there's this thing called the Knight's Tour, where you it's a mental trick where you move a chess piece around a chessboard without ever hitting the same space twice. You can see the lure of that. If I told you I've got a piece of your act where you can move a chess piece around for 20 minutes in the show, you would go, let me at it. You'd be rapid. You'd say, I'll be covered with panties. You'll not even see my face after that. You throw the dog away and just go, you mean I can move a chess piece around? I'm just huge. I'm huge. I'm Jerry Seinfeld, look out. Here I come. So
it's in Ravine's 3-hour show. It is.
Ravine is Lance Burton's manager, who of course also does magic. Everybody in Vegas, this is what you'll learn if you
you know, just that reference gave me a headache.
Yeah. Everybody here in show business also has a magic act and they sell real estate. That's what you have to learn about Vegas. Everybody has 3 jobs. You can say to anybody that you see in any one of the casinos doing any act, are you able to do your 12-minute magic thing tomorrow night? Oh yeah, sure, I'll have it. Don't even have to ask them if they have a show. They're able. I do some silk stuff. I do one Dove production. I got a few things I do.
So in terms of the magic thing, then it's all in the, you know, you got the trick. So it's all in the delivery system.
Well, it's all in everything. You know, there's no, it's the same reason that stealing in comedy is so complex.
Yeah.
Because so much is your style, so much is what you do, that is it subject matter? You know, is that kind of thing? So Ricky has a very, very strong style. I mean, it really is, you know, the erudite, all that stuff he does, the very precise movements, the tempo, all those things he does are very important.
Yeah.
And he really is probably the best scholar we have of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And he would do stuff like, you know, do pieces from 1890 with the exact pattern, you know, everything the guy said at that time.
Wow.
And do this whole, like, museum pieces thing. And so a guy's come along and is finding out what's good about that and doing that. And I haven't seen, I've seen Ricky several times, yeah, but I haven't seen this Eric guy. I don't know. I mean, you tell me. I mean, you tell me where, my thinking was always, if someone else was doing something like we were doing, we cut it immediately because it's just an ego thing. I don't want anybody after the show to go, oh, you got that thing from David Copperfield.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's the problem.
And if you got something from David Copperfield, I'd have to kill you.
Exactly.
It would end our time together.
But, you know, that's the reason. I mean, you've undoubtedly found comics that have hunks that are similar to yours.
I've never really run across. I hear it. Uh-huh. I mean, and from time to time that somebody's got. But I'm so hard to steal from because I really don't have an act.
It's difficult because he talks about crap nobody wants to hear. And he throws a bunch of goofy snapping turtle references in it, makes it palatable. But if you rip it off, you'd be an idiot because you wouldn't do it right. You'd get up there and go, I'm mad. And then you'd go, yeah, and now I'm madder because you're not laughing. Ah. So it's hard to rip up. But there's a fine line, like, sometimes I'll be on stage and I'll do something and I'll feel like, wow, that was like Jack Benny. So that's in you, you know. You know, if I could put on eyebrows and the glasses and a thick mustache and walk out on stage, you know, crouched over, that's what I would do. I mean, that's why I started, because of Groucho Marx. But every now and then I'll say something on stage.
We even understood before you said Groucho Marx.
Maybe somebody out there in the parking lot, maybe one of the jackrabbits didn't get it because they have the antennas. I thought, well, Weird House and jackrabbits with antennas. He's really living heaven out here. But I mean, you know, so sometimes you feel that way. But it feels good. I feel like, wow, that was like Jack Benny that I just did that by mistake.
I just realized while we were talking that we're having this little discussion. I'm just going, now what if another guy came along, Lewis, who yelled and had glasses and a raspy voice? How would you feel about that, Lewis? You know, people are listening going, they're doing the same thing. Lewis Black and Pendula are doing the same thing, and they're discussing two other guys doing the same thing. Either this is the hippest thing I've ever heard on the radio, or it's a bunch of retards. They have no idea what this sounds like.
Funny.
You know, but I mean, that's the kind of thing you're talking about.
Why do they do it? I don't know. Why do they do it?
Why do they do that? I don't know. I have to kill myself. Yeah, I'd kill myself too. This is gonna be. You know what drives me crazy, Lewis? Yeah, I know what drives you crazy, Ben. It drives me crazy. And they sound so similar.
Yeah, those guys are too much alike. I agree too.
But I want to just make it very, very clear to everybody listening: Lewis Black is a Jew. So, I mean, that's a whole different thing. It's a whole different background.
Whole different
point, so your background is in the New York intelligent comics, and I'm carny trash. You know, that's just, you know, your voice is that way from, you know, living a real intelligent cigarette smoking hard drinking life. Mine is this way because I've been screaming out in front of a fat lady for 2 years. It's a different way to get to the same point, you know. You were there having late night discussions at the Algonquin. I was trying to sell a two-headed snake. But where you end up ends up being very close to the same.
That's phenomenal. That is really phenomenal.
That's where you end up getting. How long are you at the MGM? You starting tonight?
No, we actually started Tuesday.
Oh, my
goodness.
And then
we're going to be there through this Tuesday.
Oh, cool. Cool.
It's nice, you know.
Plenty more shows to do.
You know, and then they said they basically, we were in the first week and we were doing, it's nice because we're doing well. I've always wanted to kind of be able to set up like this and have, because I like working this place for a week because I really do develop new material and stuff, or steal it, whatever. I come and see you, and then I yell about it.
I get a little tape of Ricky J. So you can look at here. And, you can say pachydermias.
Yeah, you want to buy a snake?
So I find my. So it's. But then they said sometime during the first week, about the fourth, fifth day, you know, we want to book you, you know, guys for 3 weeks. But we book you if you want, we'll give you four. You can do, 2 weeks in a row. And I went, no, not 2 weeks in a row. I don't think I can survive 2 weeks in a row.
It's weird. You know, they used to, back in the good old days when the mob controlled Vegas, they used to pay the entertainers in chips. Which is the most brilliant thing. At the end of every night, here you go. Here's a little few wooden nickels you can go. So the entertainers would end up, there were a lot of entertainers in the 70s that would be working off gambling debts from before. So they'd have another 3 weeks they had to work where they got paid nothing.
What was that old story, which I never know if it's true or not, about Shecky Green who threw himself onto the craps table?
Yeah.
Did you know that? Yeah.
No.
Yeah, he owed so much money, he said, I'm betting myself.
And that is Lewis Black here with John Bowman, Michael Godot. My name is Ben Gillette. We're broadcasting just out to the driveway. We'll be back after this on CBS Free FM. Ben Gillette on the Free FM, CBS. Here with Michael Godot. We have Lewis Black, and he brought along John Bowman, his opening act. Now, many comics have opening acts very well thought out that suck. Is that your thinking on an opening act? I mean, usually...
I could totally hear that. I'm not in the parking lot. I'm actually in the room. If you want me to leave, just...
Bands will often put on an actually a good band for their opening act. But comics, that's a rare thing, you know? So you go to the school that put on a good opening act.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Well, you also... I mean, we just did a thing recently out in Boston at a comedy festival with five... Really great. I mean, when you finally reach that point where this is really fun and you enjoy doing it and you're good at it, it doesn't matter what order you go. It doesn't, you know what I mean? It's like, John is really, been a headliner for, 20 some odd years, and you got to go on the road with somebody who knows you or you could really lose your mind very, very easily. especially doing, the night after night and you change in towns. It's really, and we've known each other for, ever. Mm-hmm. So it's,
it's very important. When we were on the road for 30 years, and you start picking your crew guys based on who you want to go to a strip club with. I don't care how good you are at lights. Screw that. You like to go to the same strip clubs I do. Yeah. We want to go to the dirtier ones. Yeah. So come along. That kind of thing. You got to pick your guys you're going to be on the road with. You got that. You did this Lenny Bruce tribute at the...
We did. They called it a Lenny Bruce tribute at the Y, the 92nd Street Y, and it was really... It was comics kind of just basically... It was an excuse for comics to get up instead of saying, hey, it's Purim. here at the Jewish Community Center, it was kind of another way to get at it without saying, hi, let's bring some Jews together and have some fun.
I always wondered...
So it's Lenny Bruce night.
Exactly. Why comics never did covers? We talked about the Ricky Jay thing. I always thought it'd be wonderful to hear someone do, because when you're growing up and you want to be a comic, you memorize those whole hunks of the Elbert Brooks album, the Lenny Bruce album, and not an impersonation, not like bands do it, where they're not trying to do the voice and everything, but it's just a tribute. I thought it'd be terrific to get a bunch of comics together to actually do, you do two as a preposition, he's going to do Father Flotsky, and just do those whole hunks. I've never seen anything like that done.
No, they don't. We don't. You never end up doing it.
And the same, we did that once.
It takes so long for comics to die, I think. That's the problem. You could do it after they're gone, I think. Yeah. But comics live forever for some reason.
Well, Prevenz and I did, Gilbert and I at a benefit after 9/11 in New York. I guess everybody knows where the 9/11 thing happened. But New York and Washington, for those who don't know. We did a benefit, and Gilbert and I did Who's On First.
Oh, is that right?
And then Prevenz and I did The Komodo Dragon by Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really cool. I think more people should do covers. But someone wrote...
That's almost different, too, because those covers are really the... since you got two.
Yeah.
For some reason, there's something about
it. It makes
duo
it seem more like a routine.
Because I've done the Who's On First. Uh-huh. Which was a brutal memorization process.
We had papers in front of us. And Gilbert, with Gilbert, it's a choice. He can't memorize anything and he can't really read. So whether he's going to have, it's kind of halfway between the whole thing. But you memorized Who's On First?
Yeah, I did.
These ball players have strange names.
Yeah. I'm going down to do this benefit golf tournament for cystic fibrosis in late October.
You care so much about people with this disease, you're willing to play golf?
Exactly.
Wow. you're such a humanitarian.
It's all about, you know, I don't know if you've noticed in the time we've known each other, but my life is about work and good deeds. So, but there's a friend of mine who is going along with us, an actor, and he just keeps going, can't we do Who's On First? Can we entertain the folks? Joe Grafazzi, who's a really fine actor. And you know, because I go down there and I basically host, you know, each evening I MC and da-da-da-da, and basically keep the folks entertained. And he, you know, is just dying to get back on stage. And he's going, well, let's do Who's On First. I'm going, no, we're not going to go memorizing stuff. No,
which part do you do on the Who's On First?
I do the, what's his name? The Abbott, the Bud.
The funny
Bud
one
Abbott.
Or not?
Bud Abbott. I do the Abbott.
Which one's the funny?
Well, that's the interesting thing about Abbott.
Well, let's get on the internet.
In Laurel and Hardy, Stan Laurel was the brains.
Yeah. Right.
Marx Brothers Groucho was the brains. Stooges Mo was the brains. Laurel and Hardy, Abbott Costello had no brains.
No brains.
No brains. Nobody was in control.
Which one's the funny one?
I think Lou Costello was considered the funny one because he was fat.
Yeah.
But fat is funny.
Well, I guess he was in the receiving end of the slaps. I always found the slapper to be funnier than the guy receiving. So I don't know. I might go the other way on that.
Maybe if you're going to be doing Three Stooges sketches, that's not the argument you want to use. You know, I think it'd be a lot funnier if you hit me right in the face. You know, get those, you know, tongs and put them in the fire first and then grab my nose with them. Because I think that would be really funny. And you'll get most of the laughs. I don't know if that's the strategy. But the same person that wrote in about you doing the Lenny Bruce tribute that wasn't a Lenny Bruce tribute, but more like Purim, the same guy wrote that and asked about this new Robin Williams movie?
Yeah, I did a movie with Robin Williams and Christopher Walken and Laura Linney.
Oh, my goodness. You're a star now, right?
No.
Yeah, big star.
No.
Can't move anymore. Seriously,
stop. And what are you playing?
Oh man, the two of you.
Guard number three.
Very nice. No, I actually have a
background pimp.
I have a big role in this movie.
Do you really?
Yeah. Because you know, now that they've discovered what it is that I do, it's much like discovering that Lassie was a collie, and Rin Tin Tin is a German Shepherd. So if you want the collie that barks really loud. I'm the one.
And what's the name of the movie?
The movie is called Man of the Year.
And is that the one where he's a comic?
He's a comic president? Who runs to be president.
So it's the John Stewart story.
It's John Stewart or Dennis Miller or Bill Maher or me.
Pat Paulson? Come on.
And which one
Robin is the running for president, and he has a show like The Daily Show. Christopher Walken is his business manager and becomes his campaign manager. I'm the head writer on his show.
Uh-huh.
I become his speechwriter.
Okay.
And Laura Linney is kind of the love interest in a... And actually, the subplot's really interesting because you love this kind of stuff. The subplot is about voting machines.
Oh, good. Good.
You know, which is now, oddly enough, it couldn't have been timed better because now they've, you know, now all of a sudden you hear, wow, you know, we're not going to have a paper trail? You just woke up? So Barry put this whole subplot in about the machines and not having a paper trail and how, and then the kind of money that's going into these machines. And so it's a funny movie. I think it's funny. I don't know. Who knows? You know, you do these things. 10 weeks. I was there.
Where were you?
Delightful Toronto in the winter. Oh, it was nice.
Well,
crisp and crisp.
And you have a lot of scenes with like Christopher Walken? And
apparently, I'm through the whole thing.
Oh, great. And what is it like working with Christopher Walken?
It's great. You know, I mean, you're standing there. Once your brain stops going, it's Christopher Walken! You're working with Christopher Walken! Once your brain stops doing that...
That was a Gilbert Gottfried impersonation.
Faith.
Ricky Jay. He's got your ass on the phone, man.
It was really... Once I got through that, which was like the first day we did an improv, and my brain was screaming, and then I just... I mean, it's like, it's not tough, really, because he's so good...
Mm-hmm.
And stuff comes out of his mouth that is so insane that you just have to, you hang with him and you nod. And you listen. I mean, it's Christopher Walken. You're going to listen.
Yeah.
It was really an easy gig in a lot of ways.
And did you know Robin before this? You must have known him for years.
I didn't. And we had met
Like, of course, you're also in The Aristocrats together.
Yes, yes.
You've been in the movie before.
So it was 6 months before I'd met him at a another benefit. Because, and I, let me just point out, working good deeds, something I think you could take a lesson from
okay,
my
we'll
life.
Okay, we'll have a little talk about that. So you play golf for kids who are sick? That's what you're doing? Because they can't play themselves. So yeah, you go out and play
I just
golf.
Play for them, and then they show them the video. You know, but I met him there, and so Barry had actually written this part. But I've known Barry Levinson for a long time, and we were friends. And he said, "I've finally got a part." And Robin had seen my work and really went nuts over me, and so he was thrilled. And so it was great, and I had a great time with him.
Cool.
You know,
and it's gonna be a good movie.
I think it may. You know, it's you know, the thing is you go. You
is
know,
it like liberal porn? Is that what it is?
I don't know. It's probably liberal porn.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, probably, and it probably, but.
But liberal porn is very well.
Yeah.
Very, very well.
You know, there's just not enough. There's not enough tatas. You know, naked. If I could just get, I told, kept saying Barry, can't we just like every 30 seconds throw a naked woman in? Can't what? We just that I'm chasing?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we keep people. You know,
it always works.
When
have you ever been watching a movie and they go to a naked scene and you go, you know, they didn't need this? What has it ever bothered you? You know they don't need it. You know it's not important. It's not part of the plot. But you go, good, I get to see this. Now let's go back to their little mind game.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it improves any movie at all.
I do, too. As a matter of fact, I don't know why the rest of the stuff is in there.
So, I mean, you're kind of playing the role you have with Jon Stewart in a movie kind of thing?
It's not really the role I have with Jon, because I don't really kind of write for him. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of like, you know, it's like what I do with, you know, with other comedians, really. It's that kind of relationship.
And then, so he runs for president.
He runs for president.
The Jon Stewart character. Are they going to a lot of trouble to not call it the Jon Stewart character?
I know the PR machine is certainly avoiding that, but a lot of people are going, you know, okay. It's like Jon Stewart, like Jon Stewart.
If you read, what's that?
It's a shortcut to be, you know, that's what they use. Instantly.
Sure. Right. Well, I mean, it's just if you, you know, people just, I mean, Jon Stewart is the most loved person in news in the world. I mean, it's just amazing how much, one, he's really, really good.
Yeah.
And really funny and really smart. And that, you know, that's a rare thing.
Yeah. So I kind of consider him the heir to Johnny Carson.
I was
in a larger
say like a brother.
I was God, like a
House
brother.
Is going to Jesus. He's so like Jesus.
I always thought that, you know, Johnny Carson worked really hard to not have his real opinions known on the surface.
Right.
And Jon Stewart doesn't do that. He doesn't conceal
right, that's
that at
true.
All. And so I, you know, that he certainly has the cool and the charm.
But he's
Johnny
got that
Carson.
Ability within an interview that he actually listens. And creates entertainment value from whatever he's been given, which Johnny had.
Mm-hmm.
That ability of making it was, it's not, you're not just watching somebody shill, uh-huh. which most people, most people really kind
of
end up
more than anything. Lewis Black will be at the MGM through Tuesday. John Bowman is wonderful. His new movie coming out called Man of the Year with Robin Williams and Christopher
Accepted
Walken.
Is still in theaters.
Accepted is still in theaters. That is Lewis Black, MGM. Go see him. And please, for the love of Christ, throw your panties. Would one of you just throw your panties and right on the inside, Penn says hi? Would someone please do that? Please write Penn says hi in your panties and throw them on this man's face.